For a couple of generations of Americans, the name Enrico Fermi rings a bell, possibly in some cases followed by what happened to him. He was a genius, an Italian-born physicist born in 1901. He accomplished great things, including the splitting of the atom, spent many years in the United States, and died in his early 50s. The accomplishments are truly impressive and get full attention in a new biography called by David Schwartz called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. David Schwartz is not a physicist, he admits. He's a political scientist who's worked for the State Department, the Brookings Institution, and Goldman Sachs. His previous books include NATO's Nuclear Dilemmas. David Schwartz, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
It's a real pleasure.
So, as you point out early in the book, you're not a physicist, but your father was. And how did that fact lead to this book?
Well, it's interesting. He had he passed away in 2006, and in 2013, my mom sent me a whole batch of his papers, and there was a paper in there by one of Fermi's old colleagues named Valentin Telegdi about Fermi's time in Chicago. And I read that and thought, wow, that's a fascinating guy. I'd like to learn more about him. And went to the library and was astonished to learn that the last English language biography of him was in 1970 by Fermi's great student Emilio Segre. And I thought to myself, well, so much has happened in physics since then, and Fermi's legacy has been so amazing in the subsequent years that I might as well try and write a new biography of him. I also was astonished that, you know, so much time had passed. And I do think people have forgotten who he was and how important he was, and I wanted to fix that.
Well, he really is a truly monumental figure. And, in fact, I get the sense that people are still winning Nobel Prizes now off things that he started doing back in his time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the Higgs boson, which was the discovery of which led to some Nobel Prizes a few years ago, was a direct outgrowth of some of the work that he did on the theory of beta decay. He had, in that theory, he sort of first postulated the existence of this force called the weak interaction, and a lot of work went into studying the weak interaction over the subsequent 50 years. And one of the things that Peter Higgs did was posit that the field that gives the bosons that carry the weak interaction mass must exist, and so it became known as the Higgs field, and they discovered the Higgs boson as a result of that.
I was surprised to find that Fermi himself referred to a boson back in his day, so this really, really was a sense that there was a good, strong connection between his time and ours. For the non-physicists, David, I mean, what is it hard to say what Fermi's greatest single contribution was?
You know, it's a really interesting question because there is a debate about that. I had come into the project thinking that the theory of beta decay and the weak interaction was his greatest contribution. But, you know, I've been persuaded that there's an argument that what's called the Fermi-Dirac statistics is as great. And that's the theory that Fermi first posited, which integrates quantum mechanics into statistical mechanics and allows you to calculate a whole lot of important things about condensed matter physics and about what goes on inside stars and a whole range of important applications. Fermi-Dirac statistics is really the basis of a huge amount of physics. And the reason it's called Dirac statistics as well as Fermi is that Dirac came up with the idea about 3 or 4 months later without knowing that Fermi had done it first. But he always gave Fermi credit for having come up with it first.
We'll talk about Paul Dirac more later, but I do want to talk about the Fermi's. When you talk about statistical mechanics, I mean, the fact that Fermi was good at so many things, which makes the title of the book, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, appropriate. I mean, he was able to master a number of fields just to get to physics, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. I mean, he was the last person, I think, who really viewed physics as an integrated whole. You know, today there are particle physicists, there are astrophysicists, there are condensed matter physicists, there are quantum theorists, string theorists, there are experimentalists, and then there are theorists, you know, general theorists. And you know, he was someone who just saw the world of physics as an integrated whole. And it dates back from his early youth when he began to teach himself physics and began to see the relationship between different areas of physics. He really was very unusual in that respect.
You say, and it's a quote, the story cannot be told as directly as a biographer would like. Why not?
Well, he never really exposed his inner life on paper. He didn't write a lot of letters of a personal nature at all. And the letters of a personal nature that I was able to find all focused on mundane daily activities and never really, you know, you never really entered his mind. And he didn't keep any personal diaries. You know, what he did keep in terms of diaries were all related to physics. You know, he kept voluminous notebooks. And we went through all of them. I went through all of them in the archives. And it's just all physics. He would get up in the morning at 5:30 and work on physics until 7:30, have breakfast, and then go off to the lab or teach and come home and work on physics and then go to sleep. I think he was very reticent about revealing his inner life. And so what you have to do if you're going to write a biography of him is triangulate a little bit with the experience that other people had with him. And there are a lot of memoirs and a lot of oral interviews, oral histories, that give you a sense of who the man was. And fortunately, the picture you get is a fairly consistent one.
All right, so you have to get other people's impressions of him, but it sounds like his intellect certainly makes listing the accomplishments a fairly easy task.
Yes, absolutely. And the physics is very he made the physics very accessible to physicists. And, you know, he wrote hundreds and hundreds of papers, I think 250 papers in his collected works. So it's really quite amazing how clear he was in his physics and how open he was about his physics. But about his personal life, very little.
All right, we'll explore further into the life of Enrico Fermi with David Schwartz, the author of The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the life of Enrico Fermi with David Schwartz, who wrote a book called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. We're actually just a couple of days after the 75th anniversary of the reactor at the University of Chicago going critical in December of 1942. We'll talk about that and much more with David as the hour progresses. You can join us, 800-838-3760, to swap stories or ask questions about Enrico Fermi. You can also use email, jx@jeffnet.org. David, there's a thing here, a Fermi problem, which is a term. What does that mean?
It's a problem where it sort of replicates the way Fermi thought about many things. What he would do is he would use sort of general estimates of a particular phenomenon to combine them together to come up with an answer that was within an order of magnitude correct. He could do that very, very quickly. A great example of this is the question that's often asked, I guess, at job interviews to see how a candidate might think, how many piano tuners are there in the city of Chicago? And, you know, the way you do that is you don't look that up. What you do is you, first of all, make an assumption of how big the city of Chicago is, make an assumption about how many households there are. You know, there may be four people in each household. And then you make an assumption about how many of those households own pianos, and you come up with maybe 1 or 2% of the households own pianos. And then you come up, and that gives you a number of pianos. Then you have to make an assumption about how many pianos a piano tuner can tune in a day, and you get that. And how many times a piano needs to be tuned in a year, and you get that. And then from that, you sort of work backwards into how many piano tuners there are in Chicago. And the number always comes up somewhere between 100 and 200. And that would have been just fine for a first cut of a Fermi problem.
Okay. I'm glad to hear about that. That's what that is. Well, let's come back to the beginning. Enrico Fermi, born in Rome in 1901 and yeah. into a middle-class family on the rise. His father worked for the railroad industry. A bit of trauma in the family when Enrico was 13.
Yes, devastating. He was very, very close to his brother Giulio, who was a year older, and Giulio went in for an operation on his throat, and died on the operating table. And it was a catastrophe for the whole family. Giulio was apparently a gregarious, outgoing, wonderful individual, and the two of them were inseparable. And this was a devastating loss for Fermi. Of course, because he's so personally reticent, he never really spoke about it. But one of the things we did discover in our research, it's in the book, is a wonderful drawing that Enrico did of Giulio in the year just before Giulio passed away, which shows you the love and affection that Enrico had for Giulio.
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting. The book is illustrated. There are photographs along the way as well, and a photograph of that drawing. But a photograph of the kids, and it's Enrico and Giulio and their sister Maria when they were very little, and the two brothers are holding hands, sort of apart from the older sister, and it's a sweet picture, and you get a chance to get a sense of how close they were, especially through the text as well.
Exactly, and you know, you look at the picture, and it's Giulio who is holding Enrico in a protective fashion. And I think that Giulio was really very protective of Enrico during these early years, and that intensified the loss when Giulio passed away.
Clearly a huge loss, and apparently their mother never quite got over it. It does not seem to really have done had much of an impact on Enrico's learning, though. I mean, he seems to have just continued full throttle ahead. How prodigious a student was he?
He was very, very precocious. Soon after Giulio passed away, one of Giulio's friends, a fellow named Enrico Persico, approached Enrico Fermi and established a friendship with him. And the two of them went and studied virtually everything they could about physics and about the world around them. And they did all sorts of experiments, and they really became junior scientists. And that was the beginning of Fermi's real life, not only as a physicist, but as a teacher, because he took it upon himself to teach Persico whatever he was learning.
Enrico Fermi is the discussion topic here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk to David Schwartz, who's the author of The Last Man Who Knew Everything. So physics, though, how well-developed a field was that of study by the time World War I came around, which is about the time Giulio would have been getting to high school age? I mean, rather, Enrico was getting to high school age.
Well, classical physics had been well developed in the 19th century. So everything that is known today about classical physics was pretty much known by the time Fermi was born. And in fact, when Fermi was 17 or 18, he read a 4,000-page book on everything that was known about classical physics, and really mastered it. Early in the 20th century, Einstein had come up with his special theory of relativity. And then, I think it was 1915, Einstein published his general theory of relativity, and this was fascinating for Fermi. Also in the early 20th century, physicists began to understand that the subatomic world was a much more complicated world than previously thought, and some of the laws of classical physics didn't really apply, and that's where quantum theory was developed. Now, when Fermi was a young man, some aspects of quantum theory were understood, and in particular, Bohr's idea about how the atom is structured, which was not entirely correct, but which was the basis of much of quantum theory, was understood. But there were still a lot of problems yet to be solved, and Fermi was lucky enough to be born at a time when he could contribute to the solution of those problems in his 20s.
Give us a brief sidebar sketch, if you would, David, of when we're talking about quantum theory, what that means.
Well, it means that there's an underlying uncertainty about the world. The causality in the classical model is very direct. One thing causes another thing to happen, and there is perfect predictability in principle in the classical world. In the quantum world, there isn't perfect predictability. Given one event, a number of other events could possibly happen. And while it's possible to predict probabilities of different outcomes, it's impossible to predict exactly which outcome is going to occur. And that's the essence of the quantum theory that was being developed when Fermi was young.
All right, so not all necessarily cause-effect in the way that we'd normally think. It's not that A always leads to B.
That's correct. And the consequences of that are extremely complicated and very counterintuitive. And, you know, as Feynman used to say, if you think you understand quantum theory, then you clearly haven't understood it. So, so you know, the other thing about quantum theory is that the world seems continuous to us, and it seems like it's a continuous phenomenon to classical physicists who treated it as continuous. But one of the first observations of quantum theory was that energy exists in packets. It doesn't exist continuously, and it can be divided into an irreducible packet, which is the Planck constant. And so that also has a lot of very complicated implications for the way the subatomic world works. And quantum theory is used in a lot of very practical applications. You know, modern semiconductor physics is entirely based on quantum theory. So it's not just sort of a highfalutin theory and philosophy. It has very practical consequences.
And Enrico Fermi grasped this fairly early. His entrance exam in physics for college looked like a forgery to some eyes. What was it about it that boggled the minds of the professors?
Well, it was he had been asked to describe what happens when a thin metal rod vibrates, and you know there are waves that are set up in that, and he did a wave analysis that was worthy of a graduate student dissertation on the subject. He had mastered the mathematics and the physics that are required to understand what those vibrations look like at a very high level, and he presented that as his exam. And the examiner called him in and grilled him on it. And when he was finished, he said, Enrico, one day you're going to be a very important scientist.
Wow, even then. The book is called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. David Schwartz is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. So as you mentioned, not a guy who spoke a lot about his own life, didn't leave diaries, didn't write a lot of really truly personal letters that revealed the inside, but lots of work product. And though there is this, when he went to Pisa for college, he joined something called the Anti-Neighbor Society. What was that, David?
Well, he and his friend Franco Rossetti were pranksters, and they loved to go around pulling pranks on the general public. Their favorite prank was throwing, I think it was magnesium pellets, into the urinals in Pisa while gentlemen were standing there and watching the magnesium pellets explode on contact with water. He loved doing that. He also loved using padlocks, walking up to strangers and padlocking the jackets of these strangers closed. It must have been very, very irritating. And then the two of them matured a little bit and brought some women into the Anti-Neighbor Society, and they would go hiking and on the weekends up in the mountains and picnicking and really just having fun. They were just kids, and they just had a lot of fun.
So, obviously somebody new had to blow off some steam away from work. You mentioned his notebooks already. It sounds like when on task, he was quite prodigious. Now, this is the period you mentioned Einstein already. His theories of relativity was alive and working at this time. Any sense of what Fermi thought about his work or how he interpreted
his work? He loved relativity. And in fact, one of his first papers was on relativity and made a contribution to the way relativity theory developed. It's far above me to explain it. I mean, I'm not a physicist, but I do know that he loved relativity. He admired Einstein, and in fact, he met Einstein once when Einstein was visiting the Dutch city of Leiden in 1924, and Fermi happened to be studying there. This was after his university degree. And met Einstein and was very excited and wrote back not only to Persico but to his sister Maria.
So we haven't talked much about the larger context for the life and times of Enrico Fermi. The fact is that he was too young for World War I, but then what was going on politically in Italy just as he was completing college?
Well, this was exactly the time that Mussolini took over the Italian government. The fascist party rose in a period of great social and political turbulence in Italy during this exact period. And Mussolini took over and initially, I think, had the support of the vast majority of Italians. And so Fermi, I think, probably viewed this period as one where at least things were getting stabilized again and he could get on with his work. And he generally was apolitical and tried to stay away from politics. He later on, when he was a famous physicist in Rome, he met Mussolini, I think it was 1932, and came away fairly impressed with the man. Mussolini may have been sort of a thug, but he was a very, very intelligent man, and Fermi was impressed. I think that as the 30s went on and the regime became uglier and uglier, Fermi had thoughts that, you know, I got to get out of here. I think he wanted to come to America early on. He came to America first in 1930 and was really impressed by how vibrant physics was here in the United States and wanted to come and do physics here. But his wife was also born in Rome and really loved Rome and didn't like the United States very much. And so he wasn't able to persuade her to come until Mussolini had passed some anti-Semitic laws in 1938, which affected her because she was Jewish.
All right, yeah. So this is Laura Capone, and so she there's a lot of interesting stuff about her as well. But for one thing, apparently Fermi taught Laura some physics on their honeymoon.
Isn't that romantic? That's the way I'm sure you and I would spend our honeymoon.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, he always was teaching, and he loved physics. So he thought, well, why not teach Laura some physics? But she gave as good as she got. So you know, she was skeptical and pressed him, and you know, didn't just take it for granted that you know he was a smart guy. So what he said was true. there's a great description of that in her memoir, and I reflect that in my biography.
David Schwartz is our guest. His book is The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. So what work of Fermi's first brought him serious recognition in the field of physics?
Well, I think the Fermi statistics certainly was the first thing. And as I said, the beta decay theory didn't really get noticed until a bit later. But, you know, the slow neutron work, and let me go back and explain that a little bit. In 1934, he read that the Curies had bombarded substances with alpha particles, which were very heavy, positively charged particles, and they became radioactive. And he thought, well, that's fascinating, but why use alpha particles? They're positively charged. And it's very hard for them to interact with the nucleus of an atom, which is also positively charged. Positive charges repel each other. Why not use something that is neutral, that can get into the nucleus much easier? And that would be called the neutron, which had been discovered in 1932. So he spent the year bombarding all sorts of elements with neutrons and recording what happened, and many of them became radioactive. What he didn't realize is that when he was bombarding uranium with neutrons, he was actually splitting the uranium atom. He didn't realize it because the experimental setup at the time didn't show it, and also there wasn't a well-developed theory that said that the uranium atom could be split. And so he thought, erroneously, that he was creating heavier elements than uranium. And he was quite surprised in 1939 when German scientists doing the exact same experiments came to the reluctant conclusion that they had actually split the uranium atom.
This is the details in here are part of what make this really fascinating to me. The idea that this is not in today's world where all kinds of great gadgets and detectors and gas chromatographs exist and all the devices that you could use for so many things in science. I mean, they really had to build these things, and a lot of it was guesswork that they were going to get not only that they would get the results they were looking for, but that they'd be able to measure them.
That's right. He built all of his equipment himself. It's really astonishing. You couldn't go out and buy Geiger counters, or you may have been able to, but they were very expensive and hard to find. So he built his own Geiger counters. He developed his own methods of setting up the equipment and irradiating these elements. And he was very much a hands-on experimentalist. He did a lot of the machine work himself. along with his colleagues, got his hands very dirty, and you know, ended up running up and down the corridors of his lab with radioactive elements from the room where they were radiated to the room where he would measure how radioactive they were. He got very deeply involved, but yeah, this was not this was rough and ready physics. This was handmade physics. This is not the kind of stuff you see at CERN with these magnificent, huge detectors that are designed by computers and created by machine.
No, a bunch of guys running around old brick buildings with stuff they had to make themselves. So much more to learn about Enrico Fermi from David Schwartz, the author of The Last Man Who Knew Everything. You can join the conversation with us by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about one of the gigantic figures in 20th century science and in perhaps all science for all time, and that would be Enrico Fermi. He's the subject of a new biography by political scientist David Schwartz. The book is called The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange to swap stories or ask some questions about this amazing man. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And we were just talking, David, about Fermi moving the irradiated materials around his lab. I have to wonder, and I'm sure other people have as well, about his exposure to radioactive elements.
Well, he certainly did get a lot of exposure. In his later years, he was sort of careful about this, but during this period, I think he probably wasn't. He died of stomach cancer at the age of 53, and it's quite possible that this was caused by his exposure to radioactive elements. But you know, at the same time, none of the other people in the experiments in Rome died of this kind of cancer. So you don't really know. I mean, he was always front and center in these experiments and always doing a lot of the work himself. So it's possible that he got more exposure than others. And it's also possible that it had nothing to do with radiation. We'll just never know. The science at the time wasn't good enough to really make distinctions this way.
Fermi's work, we mentioned briefly earlier, complemented and built upon the work of Paul Dirac. Who was he, and what was his theory?
Oh, well, Dirac was one of the great theorists of the 20th century, and very different from Fermi personally. Fermi, you know, was a gregarious, fairly sunny disposition kind of guy who enjoyed parties and such. Dirac was very, very quiet, didn't like talking at all, and spent most of his time alone. But what Fermi, what Dirac was able to do was put electrodynamics, the study of the interaction between light and matter, into a quantum theoretical context, which was an enormous accomplishment. He did it using very, very difficult mathematical tools that he developed mainly himself. And Fermi read this and was very impressed, as was everyone, that Dirac was able to do this, but also felt that in order to understand it better, Fermi needed to put it into his own terms. And Fermi spent 2 or 3 years doing just that and ended up writing a paper that really brought quantum electrodynamics to a broader audience. People, famous physicists like Hans Bethe and Eugene Wigner both say that they learned quantum field theory and quantum electrodynamics not from Dirac's work, but from Fermi's clearer and more comfortable way of presenting it.
It seems like the scientists that people remember best are the ones who not only made great discoveries, but were relatable, could talk to people about it, could explain it in ways that the average person could understand.
Well, Fermi was very, very convinced that that was important. He really believed that anyone could understand physics, anyone. And in fact, if a student of his didn't understand something the first time, he took even greater pleasure in explaining it again and trying to get the student to understand. He loved explaining things, and his method of explaining was to try to simplify things to the point that the student could understand it and really incorporate it into the way he was thinking.
So he did win a Nobel Prize in the late 30s, used that as a bit of a life change lever to end up settling in America. And I do remember well, even from elementary school, the story of the nuclear reactor at the University of Chicago 75 years ago, almost to the day they got the reaction going. How significant was that?
Well, I think it was very significant. At that time, no one really knew that the splitting of a uranium atom could cause a chain reaction. Leo Szilard had thought about chain reactions for a long time. He was a Hungarian physicist who was also in the United States at the time, and he and Fermi began a series of experiments to explore whether a chain reaction could occur and whether it could be controlled. And, you know, on December 2nd, 1942, in a space underneath the stands of a football field at the University of Chicago campus, they built a machine that did just that. It created a sustained, controlled nuclear chain reaction. So it demonstrated, first of all, that a chain reaction could occur. It released nuclear energy for the first time in history, and it was the forerunner of every reactor built today. Is a direct descendant in some way or another of that experiment 75 years ago. The other thing that it did was it enabled the United States to begin to build plutonium production reactors for the war effort, for the Manhattan Project. And, you know, I think many of your listeners may know that of the two bombs that that were built during the war, one of them was a uranium bomb and one of them was a plutonium bomb. So that plutonium bomb could not have been built without the plutonium production reactors that were offsprings of this experiment in Chicago. You know, the nuclear reactor today, I think something like 20% of our energy comes from nuclear reactors. But the other thing that is important to know is that a lot of the radioactive isotopes that are used in modern medicine come from these reactors as well. And so there's always a dual legacy in these technologies. And I think the final point to make is that this experiment was one of the major steps toward the development of the bomb itself.
Well, and that gets into some questions from some of our listeners. Bill in Arcata wrote in to say, when I was in fifth grade, my art and shop teacher was Fermi's daughter, Miss Fermi. I would guess after Newell Farr Davis that the last man who knew everything was Oppenheimer. Fermi was the last man who could do anything. That's from Bill in Arcata. And then Byron in Eugene takes it a step further and asks about his relationship with J. Robert Oppenheimer and the outcome of his defense of Oppenheimer.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. First of all, I love that your one of your listeners took art classes. You must have been at the lab school in Chicago because she taught at the lab school for a number of years and taught art. And I actually know someone else who had her as a teacher and they loved she loved being taught by Nella Fermi. I think the relationship with Oppenheimer was not a particularly complicated one. He had a huge amount of respect for Oppenheimer, mainly because Oppenheimer had been selected by the president to be the leader of the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos. And Fermi viewed that as indication enough of the man's importance and never wanted to disagree with Oppenheimer publicly. He didn't view Oppenheimer as a particularly great physicist. I think this is an important distinction. He viewed Oppenheimer as the guy who could make the project work. But if you look back over Oppenheimer's career, Oppenheimer doesn't have the kind of contributions that physicists revere to the same extent that Fermi does. And, you know, it's a very interesting question as to why that is. I get into it a little bit in the book, but it's an open question. Why is it that people like Fermi or others have, or Einstein or John Bardeen, who won two Nobel Prizes, how come they can make multiple contributions, and someone like Oppenheimer, who was every bit as smart as Fermi, doesn't have an Oppenheimer equation to his name, or doesn't have Oppenheimer statistics or an Oppenheimer particle? to his name. It's a difficult question. I don't know what that is. But just suffice it to say that the two had enormous respect for each other. And when Oppenheimer was accused of disloyalty in 1954, Fermi stood and defended him in the hearings about Oppenheimer's security clearance.
How did Oppenheimer's side, how did Fermi feel about the weapons that were being developed, particularly as the bombs got bigger after that initial round that Oppenheimer developed at Los Alamos?
Well, I think Fermi was always had a certain reluctance about the project. You know, he knew the Germans were working on the atom bomb and threw himself into it, but I think he also appreciated the enormity of the destructive force that that man was unleashing on the world. Later on, in 1949, when he was asked as part of an advisory committee whether the United States should go ahead on a crash program for the hydrogen bomb, he said, no, absolutely not. It's a terrible evil, and the United States should not do this. He also felt that it wasn't technically feasible. The president overruled the scientists in this respect and went ahead with a crash program, and Fermi decided it was probably better for him to be part of the project than to be on the outside. So he spent a couple of summers in Los Alamos working on the hydrogen bomb project. His main activity in 1951, I think it was to work with another mathematician, Stanislav Ulam, to try and prove that Teller's idea of how the bomb might work was incorrect. And he kept on coming up with flaws in the original idea. And it was only in 1952, that the idea for the real idea for the hydrogen bomb was developed by both Teller and Ulam.
We have another email here from Lynn in Ashland, who says, in addition to his physics work, Fermi asked a fundamental question about the possibility of other intelligent life in the universe. He very simply asked, where is everybody? It would be interesting for your guest to provide some background on this.
Well, he and Teller and a group of other people were at Los Alamos one summer, and they were talking about, you know, whether speed of light travel was possible, and you know, decided that it wasn't. Fermi was left thinking about the distances between stars and between galaxies and how many galaxies there are. And in fact, this is like a Fermi problem, like how many
piano tuners
are there, right? Exactly. So so he began to think about this, and he realized that the universe is so big that if travel between interstellar travel, intergalactic travel, were actually possible, then we would have been visited by them already. Or at least that was the conclusion he came to. And so he blurted out, almost out of nowhere, where are they all? And everyone sort of looked at him for a moment and sort of wondered what he was talking about. And when they realized, they all burst into laughter. But that was his take. I mean, there are other people who have done much more sophisticated work on this. There's a fellow named Drake who developed the Drake equation, which is a much more formal analysis of this, and I don't pretend to understand that. But Fermi did have this quip, you know, where are they all?
We did mention some of the indispensable people in his life, his wife, Laura Capone, who was with him all the way to the end, and wrote a memoir of her own. And then was there ever a sidekick, though, an indispensable partner at the labs who really helped Fermi do his work?
Well, he always had a couple of people who were very close to him. In Rome, it was, you know, Segre and Amaldi and Rossetti. Pontecorvo were very close to him. These were his sidekicks. In Chicago and Columbia, he had Herb Anderson and Sam Allison and Walter Zinn and Leona Marshall, who became Leona Libby. And these were people who were very, very close to him. You know, he didn't have one person he relied on, but he had a very small group of people who were devoted to him and with whom he worked very, very closely.
And in fact, there's mention in here of a record album, To Fermi with Love. Can you explain what happened there?
Well, you know, he was so beloved by the people who worked with him. It's hard to convey this. I try to in the book, but people really were passionately devoted to him. I think because he had this sunny disposition, he was very open, very unpretentious, and loved life. And, you know, on the weekends, he would invite people over to his house for parties, or people would go to the beach for weekends. People really enjoyed being around him. So when he passed away, his colleagues at Argonne Lab, which was the lab that was created during the war and which he worked in, put together an album called To Fermi with Love. And it's a wonderful tribute album. It's a two vinyl disc set. You can actually get it on Amazon, I believe, or Abe Books, or maybe eBay. And it's tributes from the people who work with him, and very loving tributes.
That is very sweet. To Fermi with Love. I will have to go look for that. And I should point out that the pictures in the book also include pictures of you, David Schwartz, sitting at the reactor panel at Hanford.
My wife took those pictures. We visited the reactor panel, the reactor at Hanford, and we visited the reactor at Oak Ridge. And in both cases, my wife snapped those shots, and we decided to put them in. I thought it was fun.
Following in the footsteps of Fermi, he is the subject of the book, The Last Man Who Knew Everything, The Life and Times of Enrico Fermi, Father of the Nuclear Age. David Schwartz wrote it and joined us on The Exchange. David, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.